up to season, episode 8 of season 14 here on Mention and Dispatches. Welcome back, everybody. I've got a couple of guests with us tonight from the Great White North. The reference I used to use was, you know, north of the wall. Two things. One, Game of Thrones has been off the air for a little while, so that's not quite as topical. But it's given the current geopolitical situation, I'm not sure that's as humorous anymore either.
Well, we are thinking of building one, so.
I don't blame you. Or at least like a fairly thick hedge along the way.
The beaver dam.
We will send you the bill for it afterwards.
I wouldn't blame you. Mr. Rex Brynan is back. This is, at least a half a dozen or so appearances with us over the years. And Rex was the one that was mega gaming a pandemic in the winter of 2020, right before the real one hit us. And we were all wondering if he knew something we didn't. So, Rex, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back.
And then a first timer for Mention and Dispatches, a buddy of Rex's who's worked with him on a variety of projects over the years, but a new voice here on our podcast, Mr. Ben Taylor from up there in Canada as well. Thank you, sir.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Tonight's topic, it's one of those crossovers with the professional space. And as you can see by the title of the episode, we're doing serious non-war games. Quite frequently when we have guests from the professional and practitioner space on our podcast, we're talking a lot of kinetic stuff, largely. We're bringing in folks that do things with the Marines. Later this season, we're going to have some students from the U.S. Army Command General Staff College. So we've got a mixture of folks that are involved in that professional wargaming space. We also, with the Connections Online conference that we help sponsor, that we bring a lot of those folks into the discussion. But an area that doesn't always get covered as well is the idea of using wargaming principles and processes for non-kinetic types of topics. And that's something that we were wanting to explore tonight. And honestly, one of the best known examples out there, whether he's picking fights with commercial game publishers or just, you know, teaching folks around the world how games can be used for professional development, Rex, Aftershock is kind of the standard bearer, almost the way Littoral Commander has turned into for the kinetic guys.
So for those who haven't seen it, Aftershock is a game designed as a kind of introductory teaching about humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It grew out of a Connections US professional wargaming conference where we split everyone at the conference into three. We brought in people who had deployed to the Haiti earthquake, the big Haiti earthquake, and said, how would you design a game about humanitarian assistance and disaster relief operations? You were part of that. You were there, Brant. Lots of good ideas. And I took it back to McGill and put a game together and then inflicted it on my students, since I have ready play testers, and inflicted it on other people. And that became Aftershock. But I've done quite a bit of, if I would say, the majority of my gaming. Although I'm a war gamer, the majority of my professional gaming has been around things other than trying to blow stuff up. Yes. And Ben was a defense scientist at Defense Research and Development Canada. He's now a consultant. And although a large part of his career involved trying to blow things up, a significant chunk of his gaming also involved addressing other kinds of things too. And we've collaborated quite a bit over the years on that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that is a bit of a hallmark of these kinds of games, or these are not the kinds of things that even if you did see them on a game store shelf somewhere, are unlikely to attract a ton of attention or adherence to them, largely because it's not really the purpose. Like, entertainment is a secondary consideration. I can't possibly fathom one of these games being particularly useful without at least a half a dozen people around the table. I think by design, you sort of need a crowd for some of these games, no?
Not necessarily. I think there are some novel gaming constructs that can be used. Because you've got to think with professional games, the question is always, what is the intent? What is the purpose? Is it to analyze a problem, or is it to educate, inform, and relay knowledge? So one example of something that I have supported was a version that's essentially like a sort of make your own adventure type game book type things, but for dealing with the pandemic. So I was working with some health science academics at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. We essentially, they have a game which they're currently in sort of final development and software called Pandemic Passport. And Pandemic Passport embeds in it a lot of established best practices, advice from the World Health Organization on what you should do under circumstances if you're a government. But rather than have the game played in a large group where people playing health ministry and economics ministry and the party politics can all argue what's the right thing to do, this is designed specifically to sensitize decision makers so they can look at the issues and try making decisions without doing it in front of their staffs, without being in a competitive environment. So we're actually giving them a structured scenario and they're posed with questions and they might not, and the options they have, the policy choices they're given might not be things they had thought of. We don't have a victory condition. We don't have a sort of thing that tells you, yes, successfully, you solved COVID-2 or whatever.
Yeah.
But the idea is a solo game to sensitize decision maker to the kinds of issues that might come up. So you can use a game simply to relate knowledge and insight to one individual. But conversely, I'd agree with you at the premise that sort of a large group of people who are interacting is a good thing. Because in many cases, these games are a mechanism by which people who come from different perspectives to exchange those points of view. You can have people who are public health managers. You can have people in logistics. You can have people from different areas who are coming together and say, well, it's obvious, clearly, hospitals would treat all the people. And, well, hang on, sorry, the hospital management people tell you our hospitals are busy all the time. That's what they're for. We don't have 10 open, 10 empty wards just in case you want to put a bunch of people through. So you can, by bringing different people from different perspectives, put them into a common scenario. They can then engage and expose each other's views, and they all come out a little wiser than they went in. And we may collectively understand the problem or possible solution to the problem a little bit better. So I think, yeah, you can build games for a very professional purpose with very, very huge difference in the scale. But it's all about design to purpose. Are we analyzing? Are we trying to dig into something, understanding it, or are we trying to teach? And we can do either. And the game will structure differently depending upon who you've got available, what your audience is, and how many results available.
Yeah. We had a panel at one of the previous Connections Online where we actually did discuss some of what you're actually talking about in terms of the different purposes for which a war game might exist. And in some cases, like you said, there may be some sort of training component to it. In some cases, it may be that you're running multiple iterations of it just to generate a variety of data and be able to use that data to analyze future course of action. In some cases, it's a rehearsal. And it's less of a contested event and more of a structured one so that everybody understands who goes where and does what at each point in time. In some cases, it's evaluative, right? We've taught you a bunch of stuff. Now show us that you learned it and let's play the game and grade your performance. So I do think you're right that the purpose is a huge part of this. And I think we've all seen some horror shows of multiple people showing up to an event, not all agreeing on the purpose on their way in the door. And that can make for a challenging event, let's say.
Yes, it can. And clearly using them in an education environment where the professor at the front of the class has the power and authority to say, you're going to do this because it's good for you. You might enjoy it, but it's definitely good for you. And it's been designed for you. So off you go. And the students can't really sort of walk out in protest or, well, they can try to wreck the game, but they're there. Clearly, occasionally, managers who don't understand what a war game is or could be may well invite people in or try and say, war game is cool, everybody's doing it, I want one, but I don't know why I want it, just run it and see what happens. That's not a good idea. And yes, I agree. I'm sure there have been disasters in many organizations who have done the war game just because they were told to do a war game.
Yeah, the performative war game, mm-hmm. Right? We're doing it so someone can see us doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that means sometimes when someone comes to you and says, I really want you to do a game on X, you really have to push back and say, no, you don't. you don't want us to do a game on X. You actually need this. And I'll give you a good example. Ben and I both worked on the national tabletop exercise to test out Canada's COVID-19 vaccine distribution. So emergency request, it came from the very highest levels of the Canadian government, the Canadian Armed Forces, the Public Health Agency of Canada. The results were to be briefed to the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, so it was a fairly high-stakes thing. The initial request was, we want you to war game the vaccine distribution plan. It was a giant logistics plan, huge detail. I mean, it went into how many aluminum ice cream scoops were in federal inventory for scooping dry ice. That's the level of logistics planning. And the initial request was, we want a war game. And Ben and I said, well, actually, we're not sure you want a war, because if it's a truly war game, if it's a truly, you know, there are consequences, it's linked decisions, we're only going to test out one version of history. And there are lots of things that can go wrong. What you really need is a much broader red team exercise. And then for us to take from that red team exercise some of the key things that we think people need to talk through in more detail. So we actually pushed back on the initial request, which was, literally, we want you to war game vaccine distribution. And we said, no, we think that would be misleading. What we will give you is a series of red team meetings where we will have a bunch of experts just run through the plan and say, this could go wrong, that could go wrong, this could go wrong. And that was a whole range of contingencies, from countries cutting off our vaccine supply, which happened, to a volcanic eruption in Iceland interfering with transatlantic travel, which didn't happen, but was on the contingency list.
Happened. I mean, it just didn't happen then.
Yeah. It just didn't happen during when we were getting vaccine from the EU. And then we picked, you know, 8 or 9 of those, and we ran a day long TTX for 150 people. That was not a full war game. That was, here's a scenario, here's a situation, break into groups, discuss how you would resolve the situation. Turned out to be very useful. But that was a case of us actually saying, actually, no. We know war games are trendy, but a war game that is truly a war game wouldn't be helpful. A TTX alone wouldn't be helpful. What you need is a combination of some red teaming and the TTX. And I actually think the red teaming was even more useful than the TTX. TTX was useful because 150 people who hadn't had a chance to talk to each other got a chance to talk to each other, because, of course, it was COVID rules. There weren't meetings of 150 people anywhere in the country. But so sometimes, and this is true of both military war games and serious games in other spheres, this purpose question that Ben raises is critical. What do you need it for? Tell us what you need it for, and then we could tell you, A, do you actually need a game? And then B, we'll start to think about mechanisms, players. It has to be huge and complicated, and there's benefit in doing it that way. It could be, you know, I've worked on projects which are single player online browser games for training. You're playing against the game system, you're not playing against the player, but that's because that's better for that purpose. So everything, absolutely everything, including whether you even need a serious game, comes from the why. Comes from the, what are you trying to do here? What's the objective?
Yeah.
And people forget that, and people either get excited about having a game for a game's sake, or get excited that they ran a game, even though it's not actually terribly useful what they did in terms of answering a question or training or what. It comes a tick-off box.
I think one of the things that's worth always bearing in mind is that a lot of us come into wargaming either as a hobby, as a profession, or as part of your career in defense and security, and we sort of tend to sort of think of wargaming as the big superset, and there's a carve out which is sort of non-war games. But actually, in fact, it's the other way around. A game is anything where there's a competitive environment in which decisions result in sort of have consequences. You could be playing against a scripted system, or you're playing against a human. You've got some kind of human interaction, and situations which are competitive that don't involve kinetics being thrown around and don't involve an actual declaration of war on anybody are very real. You know, corporations look at their sort of strategizing as to how they're going to look at markets, how do they protect their sort of their interests. I'm sure somebody could very well be gaming sort of things that are currently going on between Ottawa and the White House as to how you browbeat a country into submission so you can take it over? Or is it just a gambit on some other game to go into a trade negotiation? Who knows? But these are competitive. People are trying to do different things. Sometimes it is an outright competition. Sometimes it's a cooperative, but you bring different skills and resources. You've got to work out how to solve the problem together. And you can have there's a grayscale between them. In the various semi-corruptive, we're sort of on the same side, but we want to come out ahead. We want to look good. Yeah. We'd like to make sure that our ministry looks good in this crisis. And if some of the other ministries sort of take a hit, well, so that's just unfortunate. But we had a good crisis. So
I love the co-opetition term.
Yes, co-opetition. So you've got a huge number of potential, infinite number of potential competitions, which can be represented as some kind of game. A subset of them involve things that we call wars, with weapons being fired at each other. So it actually, war games are a subset of games, and the principles of what makes a game apply everywhere. It's just unfortunate. We sometimes reverse it the other way around and say, well, you've got no combat results table, therefore it's not a war game. You have no zone of control around your chips, therefore it's not a war game. We just take the war bit off. It's a game, and a game about war is a war game. It's sort of war game of a subset.
We've killed a lot of Digital Ink and a lot of both podcast and video hours over the years discussing what is a war game and what isn't a war game. And It's the sports radio comparison. When it's the dead season in sports talk radio, you can always play the hits, right? What is the Mount Rushmore of such and such topic? Who are the four greatest hockey players of all time? You know, you're really talking 2 through 5 at that point, because nobody's knocking Gretzky off the throne. But, you can always roll out those big hits. If we're ever stuck for content, right, we'll just bring on some opinionated people and talk about, well, what do you think a war game is? We can always go back to that well if we have to.
Yeah, these debates have been going on for years. I think my first ever Connections US got derailed by a giant debate over what is a war game. And I have to admit, I've got a very prosaic view of this. I have a bunch of tools in my analytical and teaching toolbox. Some of them are games. Some of them are games adjacent, red teaming, scenario discussion, what have you. Other alternative analytical methods. I worked for a while in the intelligence community. Some of it are more conventional stuff in the teaching realm, seminars, lectures. And I got to use whichever tool works. But, you know, I'm not going to get particularly excited about getting into a debate over what is a screwdriver. I think if we valorize war games or games too much, we kind of miss the point that there are problems, whether they're educational or training problems, whether they're analytical problems, and sometimes this set of approaches work and sometimes this doesn't. So I've done kinetic war games, but I've done games about sick pigs, about African swine fever. Ben helped out on that. I've done games about COVID-19 response. I've done games about infectious disease outbreaks in humanitarian settings. I've done giant LARPs to train journalism students. I ran games back in the heyday of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process, which now seems a very long time ago, in the 90s and late 90s, early 2000s, with the actual negotiators in order to get to think about original ways of wording things. It's a problem. Sometimes it's a great approach, sometimes it's not.
I think there are a couple of places out there where the definitions matter. There aren't nearly as many of them as people pretend there are. And again, I think absent, a lack of content for that week's broadcast on the part of some of our streaming brethren in the hobby wargaming world, it is, I've come to the conclusion that it is a largely useless discussion. It goes back to what you guys were saying. What are you trying to accomplish? And then let's figure out the best way to do that.
And I'd add, you've always got to think about who your audience or who your clients or who your beneficiaries are. And sometimes the term you use has to be appropriate to them. The military loves the term war game, even when it's really not a war game. The business sector likes the term war game. The humanitarian sector won't go near it. And in fact, in some cases, you don't even want to use game because it implies that you're having fun with people dying. So you have to call it a simulation or you have to call it something else. You know, so I use different words. I use whichever word is going to make the participants most comfortable with the thing that they're going to do, whether that's simulation or exercise or war game or serious game or whatever. And you cannot use the same term for each audience, because there are some audiences who love certain terms. There's some audiences. And I will say, I'll just to sort of expand on that point, that applies not only to what you call it, but that applies to what you use. Do you use dice? Do you not use dice? Do you hide the random, you know, the unknown stochastic effects from them, or do you use it? Aftershock doesn't use dice, because I know humanitarian aid personnel wouldn't feel comfortable dicing with death. It uses card draws, which are also randomized, but don't feel that way to the people you're working with. It feels more like revealing fate or the secret that's yet to be. So even with game mechanics, language, all kinds of other things, you've got to think about who your audience are, you know, their professional background, their, in some cases, their cultural background, where you're holding it. I do work for CNN Academy, and there's differences in how we do things depending on whether what country we're holding it in. There might be particular sensitivities we don't particularly want to engage. So it depends. The byword of everything I do is it depends.
I think that shows the strength of the tools in that they are adaptable to all of those kinds of audiences. Again, regardless of what you call it, that action and decision and consequence cycle of, you know, what do I do? How do we express it? What are the consequences of it? How does that inform my next decision? What kinds of decisions, if there is a thinking person on the other side of the thing, how are their decisions impacting me? How are they interacting with each other? I think, you know, as you've noted, it's a tool in your toolbox, but I would be very wary of any person who claimed that there was the one tool to rule them all, because there's no one situation to rule them all. And if there was, that'd be a pretty boring world to live in. So,
I agree very much, you know, with the way Rex sort of described the situation. I'm a military operations research analyst. Retired last year after sort of 35 years in that field. I've designed and run games as part of my professional work, but I've never been in a job called gamer. When we talk about sometimes about sort of the way you might want to use games in the analytical sense, and we talk about sort of the idea of campaigns of analysis, it's sort of related to Peter Perler's sort of cycle of research, but it's the same idea is articulated other ways in other communities. But you have the idea, you have a problem, and you understand the problem. And if you have no definition of the problem, no model of the problem, all you can do is talk about it. And that might turn out to be a kind of a seminar type game or a matrix type game where you can just bring in anything and see what seems to gel and make sense. So you get some understanding. But you might in that identify some critical issue with things like COVID. Okay, wearing masks, it'll stop the transmission, will it? You can't just argue about it if you haven't done it. And you're dealing with a virus that hasn't yet been sort of tested. But you can say, well, it appears a critical thing is the transmission mechanism and whether masks and gloves or whatever are going to help you. The discussion-based game can get you that far. You then need to go into the lab and work things out, do some modeling simulation, come back with the numbers. Say, well, actually, next time we play the game, we'll say, if you do this, it won't work. Try something else. That's not the way to that. That's not the universal sort of solution. So you can take a sort of discussion-based thing to probe the problem, bound it, understand the critical issues. Then you can go into other techniques to generate insights. Maybe when you come back, you can now produce a more structured rules-based war game to try and integrate the knowledge that's being developed back into something that players can work with, giving them again a richer understanding of this problem they're trying to solve, which might then spin off further activity. So getting people to create, to innovate, exchange ideas is an approach to tackling the problem. It's not the only one. And as a professional analyst, you ought to be mixing and matching them as you go. One of the advantages in working in a small organization is you don't tend to have role specialization. You don't have Department of War Games, Department of Advanced Mathematics, Department of whatever. Everybody does a bit of everything. Once you've broken it down, as we know, any organization, once it breaks down into a functional structure, you've then got sort of rent-seeking behavior, boundaries and silos. So the board game department has to tell you that it can solve any problem, provided you keep funding it. Because its reason to exist is to keep existing.
Licking ice cream cone.
Yes.
Yeah. There's no shortage of those.
Our 14th season of Mentioned in Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters, but especially our regimental patrons who supported us at the top level. Regiment of Strategy Gaming would like to thank Stagger Wing, Paul LaFontaine, Matthew Rowe, Joseph Knoll, Fred and our favorite podcast dog, Kevin Bertram, Catastrophe Games, Patrick Garrity, Michael Sundborg, and Andy J. Wargaming is our jam, and they help us spread it. You too can join the Armchair Dragoons as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
I don't want you to give away any trade secrets or like get anybody in any trouble for, you know, talking about a project you shouldn't be publicly discussing. But I am curious. I'm sure each of you have in your background somewhere a particular success story of one of these serious non-war games that generated a particularly key insight that wouldn't or was unlikely to have been found without the war game. That aha moment that, holy crap, we really should be doing something a little different. And you know, Rex, I'll let you go first here, but is there a particular one you can think of that you're allowed to talk about that that came out with one of those sort of blinding flashes of insight that you guys at the end of it all went, wow, it's really good that we did this because we learned X during this process?
Well, I'll give you two different.
And it's coming to you, so be thinking about it.
I'll give you two different answers. I mean, I think in some ways the work I'm proudest of was the work that Ben and I and some other people did supporting the COVID-19 response, because that game was done with like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks notice. I mean, it was all hands to the wheel, emergency, had to get it going. It kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We had like 140 odd people or whatever the number was at the end. And I'm pleased with that, not because I think we revealed any deep secret, but because when we actually did two follow-up surveys afterwards and I did some interviews, people said, oh, I was really glad that took place because a thing happened in the red teaming or in the TTX, which then later happened. And I was kind of ready for it because it had happened. We talked about it in the red team and we talked about mitigation measures, or it happened in the TTX. So the fact that people both immediately afterwards and a year later were saying, oh, that was not a waste of time. That may seem scant praise. It was not a waste of time, but this was COVID. This was when public health professionals were pulling 80-hour weeks. When in North America, I mean, the death rate was much lower, higher in the States, obviously, and we had massive loss of life and the risk of even larger loss of life. So for people to come back a year later and say that day was not a waste of time in the TTX, it was actually quite helpful. So I think professionally, I'm really proud of that. Personally, I'm really proud of the work I'm doing right now with CNN Academy, which is using a fictional environment to train journalism students. But the fun thing there is the whole reason it exists is because some of my students who did the original simulation at McGill 15 years later ended up being at CNN and said, this was such a great learning experience. At McGill, it was a peace building exercise, week long, 100 students. Can you end a civil war, stabilize a post-conflict country? Now at CNN, it's doing reporting in a post-conflict country. But the fact that the people who were involved in it liked it so much that years later, they came back and said, we'd like to use this, which was for political science students. We'd like to use a version of that setting for training journalism students. That's great. And the students are great. And I have so much fun doing it. So the first is the, you know, professional accomplishment. The second is the, you know, fun for me.
Yeah, I would say that I think the not a waste of time is not scant praise at all in the context of what was happening with COVID, given all of the other things they could have been spending their time on.
Including, I wrote an entire blog post on Pax Sims on Do No Harm, because everyone wanted to do COVID gaming. And I said, whoa, these people are busy. It is unethical to game with them unless you are bringing value added. So for me, it was not a waste of time is actually the highest possible praise for busy people in the middle of a crisis in which millions of people around the world died.
Fool's Gold.
Ben, what about you?
Well, I think we'll sort of have a couple of answers, but before I go into those, I'll just sort of add a little bit onto what Rhett was talking about, the COVID vaccine exercise. I'd agree that very much is a highlight because of the circumstances and the time that it was done, but also the network, the huge importance, particularly so in the non-war type games, where you've got such disparate organizations, professional perspectives. It's the ability to play your networks, the people you know, the people you've met, the people you've done one kind of thing with, you can bring them into something else. So we managed to put together in our sort of red team, we had retired senior police officers from the sort of special security sort of side of the RCMP. We had professors of public health management. We had former sort of government central agencies or senior officials, people who would never meet. They work in completely different places, but because we've met them in different guises, they all come in online, and then you have all these different people sort of sparking off each other and creating things. And I think we were, as well as the impact and the immense and positive reception the exercise had, and also, we noted that, I think as Rex said, we had sort of a series of little vignettes or problems that, you know, we threw at the people to work at. Of the ones we came up with, the majority of them actually happened. So we weren't inventing, well, what if the Martians land, or what if this happens, what if, you know, something outrageous. The things that happened, they weren't necessarily obviously going to happen, but they did. One of the examples was a neighboring country cuts off its vaccine, reneges on its contracts, and keeps all the drugs inside its side of the border. Then we had one about a factory had to be sort of taken offline to retool, and then a whole bunch of stuff was lost. Well, that happened in real life. In our version, the factory burned down in Europe. So there were meant our expert red team panel actually came up with a fairly good projection as to what could be facing us in the months ahead. But from my examples of sort of two successful games, none of these have an aha, we've got a result we can then go and publish and do something with. But they were very positive in other ways. The first one was a Matrix game that was developed about a hypothetical, fictional flu pandemic, which we ran in the spring of 2019. We were just 1 year early. And this was a project run for Global Affairs Canada, so our foreign ministry. And they wanted to look to see whether games were a potential tool to help advise them on sort of policy making and sort of situation analysis. So a group of us got together to create this game. But we wanted to make sure that people who had a great deal of knowledge of environments weren't in the way. Because one of the problems with a war game is that the game designer knows less about the problem than one of the players. The player will point out why your game is wrong. So we got the map of Pangaea, the supercontinent of 200 million years ago. So, and we created these sort of blocks of Northland, Eastland, and Southland, Westland. And you can guess what they're like. And we sort of dropped this pandemic in the mix. The game was played. It ran a day. There was teams of 4, 5, 6 playing, each of sort of 6 or 7 roles. But the positive reaction around the room from people who engaged was immensely sort of rewarding. And we did a sort of a feedback survey after the game. And a couple of interesting things came out. One of the things that they were looking at was the attention placed to gender-related issues. And it was in several players' narratives sort of hints, you are supposed to be pushing on this. This is a key priority. Nobody ever referred to a gender-related issue in any of the arguments they made throughout the entire game. And as the researchers who research gender-based health outcomes point out, this is true because everybody always talks about something else. Does it affect women or other sort of equity-seeking groups is always left off. It's never a priority. So even we had a game to say, can we get sort of treatment of gender issues in public health in the game? We repeated the real-world result of no. We also had feedback from people who had worked in overseas aid organizations who said that the behaviors they saw, the interaction between sort of the Western intervention, the Western people trying to help, help is inverted commas, and the Southland organizations trying to solve their problem their way, sort of the condescending sort of the white savior syndrome. I've got a college degree in being nice to people. I'm going to go to Africa and solve their problems. That came out in the game as well. So we saw some very realistic behaviors in a game that took, as Matrix games typically do, a very simple generation and no models underneath it. It's simply a discussion-based game. So that was rewarding, and that led to a connection to one of the health science academics, Julia Smith, at Simon Fraser University. She was taken by the power of the immersive experience of looking into a game like that. And we started kicking around some ideas for how to build a game that would fit into a pandemic management or public health crisis management sort of course that was being run in the health sciences program. And we came up with this game, which had models. Here again, we're going back to this issue of design to purpose. What are we trying to do? If you are trying to give an undergraduate class an experience of dealing with something, you cannot expect them to come with expert-informed views about what should and shouldn't be done. They haven't absorbed all the literature. They're trying to learn the principles. They're undergrads. So we created a little continent with six fictional countries, some richer, some poorer, some liked each other, some didn't. Some have hang-ups about sharing their money, and others have got none anyway. And we created some little models for about how different things like sort of infection rates and intensive care loading and economic losses. And essentially the players have a sort of little control panel. They have a number of policy areas they can try and adjust, and then they can work out whether they want to sort of help each other with resources or deal with the problem. Again, this was all done during the pandemic. So I was, the initial version of this, I was running it from my basement in Ottawa to a virtual class being linked through people in Vancouver, sort of 5 hours flight away. But we had a sort of video link, and I had a view in my camera where I could see the room with all these sort of teams dotted around. And the game was designed to run in the morning. Essentially, they had a briefing session sort of early in the week, so they know what they should do. They're assigned to teams, and they come in and play. And the thing that struck us through this was how the students actually were emotionally engaged. They actually cared for how their countries were going, were surviving, and sort of the faculty there, sort of, we had a wash up afterwards. They'd never seen anything like it. The level of engagement, the real sort of the majority of them took it so seriously. And feedback for them at the end, later at the end of the course, was this was the highlight. It was designed as an integration exercise at the end of a 10-week program. You've had the lectures, now go and do it. But it meant the sort of the course had this sort of final integration step, which was fun. They really enjoyed it, and so the end of term papers were of a higher quality than they'd ever seen before. Sort of the average standard was better because somewhere the little connections were made, sort of in a person that personally experienced sort of the challenges, that's an immensely positive experience as a game designer to get that kind of feedback and to realize you've built something that is now a useful part of an established training program rather than as a one-off. That was firstly a crude sort of prototype, but we then rebuilt it with much more detailed models based on the emerging literature of what was happening. This was work done in 2021-22. And they've actually now had it coded up as a standalone tool so they can actually run this game. But I don't need to help them anymore. They've now got this, and they can wheel this out and run it in the classes, and they've now used it 4 years in a row. So I take great sort of personal pride from having sort of built something like that that is actually useful to people.
That's really cool that first of all, that the faculty noticed an immediate effect in the quality of the student output after it, but also that they've sustained it. Rex is familiar with the Gemstone project that I worked on back at NDU 15 years ago now. Yes, we're all getting older. But the it was when we were first brought in to work on that project, it was really weird to me because this was the kickoff game. Like, this was the first thing they were doing walking in the door. And I'm scratching my head because most of my experience with it had been similar to what you were just describing, Ben. It's the last thing you do at the end of the course. It may be an evaluative exercise or kind of a capstone thing where it's a chance to integrate all the different things that you've learned. But this was something they did right when they walked in the door. And I'm thinking, what the heck? Like, what's going on with these guys? Like, they're paying us. We're supporting it. Like, you know, at a certain point, you're cashing the check. But going in, you're sort of wondering, what the heck? And really, it as it was explained to me, it made perfect sense after, you know, after learning what was going on there. But it did a couple of things. One, it gave the faculty an opportunity to observe what level of expertise they had coming in the door, right? You got a chance to see what the students knew and what they didn't know and got a sense of how much of what kind of ability you had coming in the door, because these were relatively senior leaders in military and government positions. Very few, it was an international class, so it was very few Americans. I think out of 80 people in the class, there were maybe a half a dozen Americans in there. The vast majority of them were internationals. It also gave the students an instant bonding opportunity. Right now you're sort of thrown in the water with your friends and you got to figure it out or become, you know, friends and figure it out. But it also something that the faculty didn't even necessarily expect. They were looking at it as this was a bonding exercise and this was a chance for us to assess the knowledge of the students coming in. The thing they didn't expect, but we heard about when we came back the next year to do it again, that we heard from the faculty, one of the things that they really liked from the previous year is after that exercise, the faculty had a common reference point for everyone in the room that they could always point back to and go, hey, you remember when this happened during the exercise, and everybody knew what they were talking about. You didn't have to refer to a historical example that maybe some people didn't know or something that happened in a particular country that only a few people were familiar with. Everybody had been through that exercise and everybody remembered what happened. And so you had a common reference point for the lessons that you were working on going forward. And never in my life, you know, up until that point would I have thought, hey, you should lead off with the game. But that was kind of neat to watch not only an entirely new way to use this war game tool. And again, this was a fairly kinetic thing because it was a counterterrorism, counterinsurgency course. So there was plenty of shooting going on, even though that wasn't the only tool in the toolbox in that game. But for me to learn that, hey, there's a new way to do some things, that was kind of cool. But then to come back the next year and find out that the faculty actually learned a whole lot of things they weren't expecting, that was also kind of cool. That was pretty neat in the way they approached the games going forward after that. So that was kind of neat to see.
Yeah. No. I think the idea of using a game almost like an icebreaker mm-hmm. or to create a shared understanding is valuable in itself, even if you then go on to do a subsequent exercise. We did something, this is again straying back towards the sort of more conventional kind of wargaming. So I was working in a strategic planning group in the Department of National Defense in Canada, and we had a number of high-level planning scenarios which we were going to investigate through a sort of structured sort of analytical process. But I persuaded the military officer running the process to introduce a high-level game. Sometimes there were different ones of different scenarios. Some were matrix games, some were sort of seminar games. But we got all the people who were coming from different areas, coming from Army, Navy, Air Force, and all the various sort of other functions. They're going to come in and spend a month working on this thing. But we're going to play a game first of the scenario to get a feel for, you know, who's doing what to whom and why. Because some of these were multi-actor kind of scenarios. So it isn't necessarily clear who's going to do what, where they're going to do it. And if you just read the scenario, country X falls into civil war, the government are sort of hanging tough and the rebels are in the mountains and they're trying to overthrow them. And then the UN goes in and tries to keep people apart. And then there's some sort of fanatical terrorist groups trying to blow up somebody else. You can create all this. But if you haven't put it on a map, you haven't moved it around, haven't actually got people to realize, oh, well, surely these two people don't have anything against each other. Why aren't they cooperating on this? Or, well, these two ladies can't coexist because they're trying to do quite different things. And it looks like this valley between the mountains and the sort of the agricultural area, that it clearly is going to be the critical ground where these two sort of areas of influence band. So by playing this game, the outcome isn't important. What is important is to actually, everybody there goes away with a sort of shared understanding of the dynamics of the scenario and some of the possible key points and challenges that are going to come up later. So as a sort of scene setter, to then go on as a precursor into something else, those again proved useful. The people running them said they got some insights out of the game directly, but it meant that sort of the next stage, everybody was grounded. We could all point back, oh, remember when the terrorists did the bombing, and blah, blah, blah. Well, everybody was there, everybody saw it, and then when they're going to talk about sort of how that could have been done or how that could have been stopped, they've all got a sort of common frame of reference, and you don't have the problem that you can do with people coming in, reading it through the lens of their organization. You know, the Air Force assumes somebody will secure all the airfields from them, and there's unlimited fuel available everywhere. And sometimes that isn't true. So setting the scene and seeing how it's working out, so everybody starts from a common frame of reference, makes everything else, you know, that much stronger.
The majority of our audience, quite frankly, are hobby war game types, and with a passing interest in a variety of other areas. And again, we do bring the practitioners into the fold where we do want to address issues that matter to them, like this topic, but then also to help expose them to what hobby wargaming has to offer and where there may be some professional overlap from the hobby space into the professional space. And to that end, I am curious if there have been times and if you've got particular examples you can think of, where you beg, borrowed, or stole from the hobby wargaming world for a particular type of tool or mechanic or mechanism or process that you were able to incorporate into one of these professional events that you used, whether it was the way in which you draw the map and express things on the map, whether it was introducing folks to what counters with, you know, values on them for different capabilities look like on the map. Obviously, as soon as you get dice out, you like scare half of your audience. Like they're just, oh my God, dice, bad, no. but you know, Rex, as you said, you know, we're not rolling dice in the humanitarian assistance disaster relief world. We're going to use cards because cards are sort of evocative of varying situations that may be going on and feel a little more scripted than just the randomness of flinging dice around, even though the way you shuffle still randomizes the cards. Are there particular times in which a specific tool or capability that you brought from the hobby world actually really helped out or made a difference in what you did in that professional practitioner space?
Yeah, it happens so often and so unconsciously, it's hard to talk about, right? You're designing a game and you have played so many games that you will use a this type mechanism, or you'll know from having played other games what kinds of game mechanics, what kinds of game systems, what kinds of game presentations will work. I teach a course on conflict simulation design at McGill University. About half of the projects are kind of military or military adjacent games. About half of them have got nothing to do with it. They're on, you know, global warming or plastic pollution or managing a national park or you name it. Yeah. But I make them play a whole bunch of war games at the beginning just so that most of them aren't gamers, so that they can see gaming mechanisms. So it happens. I mean, one of Dunnigan's two golden rules of war game design is plagiarize, but the others keep it simple. And yeah, you do it unconsciously. We're like AIs, right? We suck up all the knowledge from the wargaming hobby and then we regurgitate it in new game design. I will say, however, two slight caveats to that. There can be a problem, and I have to resist it at times, with hobby wargamers wanting to take a preferred wargaming mechanism and use it elsewhere, even when it doesn't work, right? Not every problem needs a CRT. Not every problem needs a hex map. As you know, a couple of my students were the original designers behind We Are Coming Nineveh, which won a Charles Roberts Award for Best Tactical War Game last year. They hated some of the stuff that was common in the hobby field. They couldn't stand hexes and they couldn't stand CRTs. And I remember them telling me when they were undergrads, we want to design a game, but we hate CRTs. We don't know why. They're just so ugly and messy and can't stand them. And we don't like hexes. We want area movement. So there could be times when hobby wargamers can get overly attached to the way that they've done things. And that's why actually I have found it sometimes really useful to be working with people who are not wargamers, who say, a bit like the Grinch Stole Christmas, why? why are you using a CRT? Why? Because sometimes you need someone to say that particular emperor doesn't have any clothes, or at least those clothes might be great for whatever, but they don't work so well for this. So A, constantly using stuff from my other gaming experience. On the other hand, sometimes you're going to be careful because you actually require a new way of approaching, and it's sometimes useful to have people who are not gamers. And, you know, for We're Coming Nineveh, Juliet, who was the main force behind it, was not a gamer in the slightest. And that was really handy because she kept asking questions about, but why do it that way?
Yeah.
Another way of doing that. So it's a bit of both. You're constantly plagiarizing from every game you've ever played, but occasionally you've got to stop and say, okay, that's the way it has been done. That's a mechanism that's out there, but is that mechanism actually useful for the audience and the problem that I'm addressing here? So it's a bit of both.
I want to throw in the shameless plug. We do have several sessions of We Are Coming Nineveh on the schedule for Origins this summer as a part of the Wargame HQ. Ares Games are going to be there with us as one of our publisher partners in the Wargame HQ. We're going to have one table of nothing but Ares stuff all weekend long, plus a couple of their games spread out elsewhere. But we've got three or four iterations of We Are Coming Nineveh on the schedule this summer. So folks want to come see what the big deal is. We got plenty of wargaming to keep you busy at Origins, and that's going to be one of them. Dan, what about you?
Well, I think there are times when you can take mechanisms from the hobby side and move them into the professional. I think one of the big challenges is that if you're working inside an environment where people are not gamers, but actually real professionals and really doing the real thing, the thing that they're uncomfortable with is the kind of abstractions and aggregations that a wargamer just takes a second nature. Yeah. Those of us who have grown up with sort of Avalon Hill, SBI, Hex and Canter maps, we know we can move our little cardboard battalions around, and then we can also play another game where we're moving cardboard divisions around, and it's just a blob. It's in one hex. But we understand the abstraction. Yes, it has a front line, it's facing somewhere, it has a reconnaissance screen in front of it, it's got a rear area logistics, its artillery is somewhere safe. You know that the little people who make up that piece of cardboard are going to do the sensible thing, but we can abstract it and just say, well, the center of mass of that division is there on the map, and get on with it. If you try and talk to actually military professionals, that that's the way you're going to represent warfare, they just hairs on fire because it's not how it's done. It's not realistic. They want it down at sort of one-to-one scale. Where is everything, and have it look like the world they understand, and in which they are professionals who really work. So there are times sometimes you need to work to build in some abstractions and artificial things to make the sort of the professional game a little bit better. One example I can give from much, much earlier in my career in the mid-90s, when developing a combat simulation model, or another team had been developing as a combat simulation model, it had the idea of sort of groups of forces moving around, and each sort of unit had a little table that said what's in it, numbers of different sort of tanks, armed personnel, carriers, missiles and things. And there were tables that a little calculator worked out when two units hit each other, sort of how many bits got knocked off each other in a round of combat. The problem was that sometimes a combat unit would run up into a reconnaissance unit, and the reconnaissance units aren't very big, aren't very strong, and they lose the battle very quickly. And well, that's not what a reconnaissance unit does. It observes the enemy and gets out of the way. Or if an artillery unit knows an enemy is coming, it leaves if it knows. So wargamers will recognize the retreat before combat rule. Roll the die, back off, evade. It's a standard abstraction in many sorts of recreational war games, both miniatures-based and sort of hex and counter-based. But to the people who say, well, I've got all the data from the test, from the firing ranges about how this tank works, how this missile works. I've got everything you ever want to know about the platforms. You've just got some crap platforms against some good ones, and you're going to die. So, well, that's not how an army fights. So,
yeah.
you bolt on the before combat rule to a professional simulation, and all suddenly and suddenly it's a better simulation. So yes, you can bring things like that in. Another example comes from that game COVID-35, the sort of the student classroom exercise. Well, in that one, you have the challenge. In theory, you would say a government can order any policy at any time because they're the government. That's what they can do. But in practice, the government machinery only goes so fast. And there's a great tendency to not want to leap from one end to the other. Governments like to do things incrementally. Let's just try asking people to stay at home. Now let's ask them not to go to parties. And you gradually ratchet things up. So in COVID-35, countries have a certain number of resource points, or people will know, recreational gamers will know them as command points or those such things. And it costs you a certain number of points to move a lever between settings. But it's not linear. If you want to move it two settings, it's 3 points rather than one. So it encourages you to ratchet things up slowly over time. Now, so that's an abstraction. You're enforcing the kind of behavior that bureaucracies really show. You're forcing a resource decision, but you don't really have a situation where sort of the central agencies and the government tell, well, health, you've got 6 points, finance, you've got 2 points, border services, you've got 3 points, go ahead and make some moves. That's not how it's done. But that kind of command and control, you can't do everything at once kind of abstraction that the hobby gamer understands and is happy with, is a bit of a shock to the system in the professional space, but it makes for a more credible, realistic flow. The challenge is making sure that the abstraction doesn't break the world. It's such an artificial thing that you're no longer studying the real problem. But in this case, you can't do everything at once, and you can't implement the most extreme policies straight out of the box. That mechanism sort of, you know, I think was effective in limiting people's ability to act without having to give them a whole lot of very, very complicated rules that would have otherwise slowed the game down.
Something that I've seen over the years is that, and this has been true throughout any sort of educational or professional development sorts of gaming that I've dealt with. A lot of the abstractions, but honestly, it's almost the interface with which you interact with the game. As a hobby gamer, there are a lot of conventions we take for granted, whether it's hex maps, whether it's blocks versus counters, dice, CRTs or no CRTs, because it's a bucket of dice that you're figuring things out. The abstractions of you stacking limits based on logistical throughput or whatever it might be. There's a lot of that interface that hobby gamers take for granted that professional gamers need time to learn. The thing is, that's true even for gamers learning new types of games. You hand somebody a video game console and it's a type of game they've never played before, they're going to have to spend their first good chunk of time just learning the interface. And once the interface is no longer a problem for them, then they can focus on learning the lesson you want them to learn on the other side of that interface. That was an unintended result of some of my PhD research back when I was still working on that years and years ago, that one of the things that we learned was there are great lessons that can be learned from that level of immersion, but only once the users are comfortable with the interface. Otherwise, they're spending their time learning the interface instead of learning the lesson you want them to learn. And I think whether it's a keyboard or a console, a console controller, or the different ways in which we express things on the tabletop, having to figure that interface out can take some time, and holding is necessary.
That could be a significant difference between a lot of hobby gamers like the rules. They like delving into the Italian water pasta consumption rule.
Yeah.
Or what have you. They like the game mechanics. With professional audiences on non-kinetic games, even sometimes with kinetic games, they don't want to drown in that. That, you know, if they're having to spend times working out combat ratios and terrain effects or infection rates or whatever it is, if they have to spend a lot of time learning the game, the time they're spending learning the game rules is not time spent moving them towards their learning or analytical objective. So that's something you have to be careful about, because a lot of us, like a lot of people, I have a fair number of games on my shelf that I have not played properly yet, but I bought them because I wanted to read the rules and I wanted to see what the designer had done. And I played around with them a bit, but I still haven't sat down with a proper opponent. But I'm so glad I have them because I thought, it's really clever the way they've done that. So we get a bit geeky as war gamers about our rules and mechanics. And when you're with professional audiences, both military and non-military, but we're largely talking non-military here, you've got to be careful that you're not overwhelming with them with that. They need to see enough of it to understand cause and effect, but they do not need to see or experience or have to understand or learn the rules for so much of it that the whole thing becomes, we're now going to spend 3 hours or a week learning rules instead of learning about the thing we're trying to learn about. Right. So that is that is a big difference.
Let them make the decisions and you execute the rules.
It might be very simple game mechanics. It might be digital. It might be simplified. There's all kinds of ways you have to deal with it. But if you are running a serious game and the players are learning more about the game rules than they are about the subject matter, you have made a mistake.
Yeah.
That's absolutely the case. And again, it's a lesson I think game designers who come from the hobby environment need to learn when they move into the professional environment, is that the professional the player in a professional game is there to bring their subject matter expertise to a problem and try and understand it, or they're there to learn something they're going to use in the real world. So memorizing the number of how many action points it takes to change facing of your unit is not a real world thing. Learning the complex game sequences, learning how to calculate whatever combat is not what they're there for. And in fact, it's worse than that, because if they're thinking about that, they're not thinking about the real problem. So the players should play in the real world, in real world terminology, real world effects, real world actions. And the game designer is going to have to take everything away. There are different ways of doing this. You can make sure there's a member of game control team with everybody, every team who's playing, so that person can translate the real world into game world for the players, so the players can stay in real world. And there's almost the idea of there's almost an equivalent of a Turing test for games. If you're playing and giving orders to your military unit to do something, and you get feedback comes back to you later, how can you tell whether the people behind the screen, the game controller, is using a massively complicated billions of dollars of software on a supercomputer, phoning a friend to ask him what they think should happen, tossing a coin, just making it up, or has a classic SBI game in the back and he's furiously trying to keep up with the players? If the feedback comes back and all you know is you've made contact with an enemy reconnaissance screen on the far side of the village, how that reconnaissance screen got there and how we decided you've seen it, you shouldn't care. You shouldn't even know. It shouldn't make any difference whether there's a hugely complicated system behind the screen or an adjudicator just making it up on the fly. The players should not know the difference, and that would be an ideal interface.
As we start to wrap this up, because as we're recording, we're a little over an hour here. Once I edit out me saying a whole lot of times, I'm sure we'll shave 10 minutes off of this. But I first of all, I'm a little disappointed we still haven't mentioned fisheries and conflict over fishing grounds at all in the hour and change that we've had here. But I do want to kind of give each of you a bit of a last word in terms of a particular insight or thought or approach that you think hobby gamers should take or should adopt when looking at kind of the non-war games, the non-kinetic war games, as you're a hobby war gamer grappling with, hey, what are these things? What should I know about them? What should I care about them? What is a key takeaway that you think that they should have around that topic? And Ben, I'll throw it to you first, then we'll let Rex wrap it all up here.
Okay. I think, as I said earlier, sort of war games are a subset of all games. Calls for outrage from some listeners. you can game anything in which there is competition. You are trying to take advantage, come out better in some kind of conflict. After all, if you look at the Euro games world, there's myriad games, majority of which don't actually have any representation of kinetic conflict in them at all, but they're definitely competitive, they're definitely games, and definitely fun. The serious games created in the non-war space may be fewer and further far between, and the hobby gamer isn't likely to run into them. But as we said earlier, the purpose of the game, of the professional game, is either to teach or to, or to gain insight, to understand something coming out of the game you didn't know before. And that's not easily boxed up and shrink wrapped and put in the mail. So you're not likely to see those sorts of games, but when they are out there, they can be as enjoyable to play and as rewarding in experience as a conventional kinetic war type game. It's just a different kind of competition, but you can still win and you can still enjoy the experience.
Yeah. Rex, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you need to measure all games against what they're trying to do. A hobby game is, well, trying to sell itself, yeah, right? And to sell itself, it has to deliver enjoyment at a reasonable price, and that the criteria. In a serious game, there's a whole range of things you might be trying to do. Often they are fun. Often them being fun is valuable, but not always. Usually they need to be, I think, engaging and immersive, but not always. It depends on what you're trying to do. But we do know games get people to think strategically about problems, that the human interaction is really valuable, that people learn more by role-playing than they do just reading about a role, that they anticipate outcomes better by playing through them than just reading a briefing sheet and saying, this is what I think would happen. We know that there's research on that. So games are a very powerful tool. They are not a magic wand. There are times when you don't want a game. It all depends on what you're trying to do. And you'd think that that would be a simple axiom. What are you trying to do? And then we'll design for purpose. And I can see, because we're, even though this is a podcast, we're recording it on video and Ben is smiling, the amount of times when you have to go to someone and say, yeah, but what are you actually trying to do in this game? That's one of the key things about designing serious games. You need to think about what you're trying to do and therefore what game mechanics, approaches, mechanisms, time, number of participants, immersion, whatever gets you to that purpose.
Yeah. And I, you know, as we were talking about some of the different kinds of games earlier, we've all dealt with classroom environments at some point in our lives. Rex still permanently going to be dealing with classroom. There are times where you may pull a game out simply to just change what's happening in the room, right? Just to wake everybody up. And it's, you're not necessarily trying to impart a specific lesson or to evaluate a specific learning objective or something. You're just doing something different just to get people moving around the room and paying attention to say, and that's a perfectly valid reason to roll out an activity like that. There's nothing wrong with it. Alongside all of those other, you know, is it analytic? Is it evaluative? Is it a course of action comparison? Is it a rehearsal of something? There's nothing wrong with just sometimes pulling something out just to change things up, get people's attention.
I'm sure you've heard me say it before, but I like to think of serious gaming, in the educational context, as a kind of intellectual cross-training, right? We've got seminars, we've got reading, we've got lectures. They're all pretty good. They do stuff, but it's just nice to exercise your mental muscles in different ways. And so it's usefully thrown into the mix. Despite being someone who teaches about games, design games, gets paid to design games, sometimes I think they're great. Sometimes I think they're not very helpful. Sometimes they're okay, but I wouldn't want to just do that. You've got to mix them. And usually, Ben alluded to this earlier, when we're running serious games, it's part of a broader process. It's not just the game. It's not just we're going to play the game and go home. It's part of teaching, debrief, analysis. It's actually a cog in a much more complex educational training analytical process.
Yeah. Well, and kind of closing on this a little bit, you know, Rex, you talked about all of the different things that you do with gaming, and yet you still will ask people, is this really the best thing that you should be doing? The one thing you did not specifically mention that you do with gaming is the one person that would continually say, oh, hell yeah, you need a game for that. You're not a game salesman, right? And so because you're not in the sales business, you don't have to constantly convince people this is the right answer. You can take that step back and say,
I'm allergic to that. I would hate to be in a situation where I was trying to sell someone a game when I thought they didn't actually need a game. I do have colleagues who are in that situation because of where or who they work for who have to do that. But nice thing about having a professorial salary is I could just say, no, I don't think that's worth doing. And I do that. occasionally.
I've seen those guys and I feel for them because there are times where I can tell their heart's just not fully in it. And I understand, and I'm sure you guys do too, from having been in those situations, that man, to have to go in and make that case when you know it's not the right case to make, but your salary depends on closing that deal, man, that's got to suck.
Well, I think Ben and I were really lucky, along with our partners, when we did the COVID-19 vaccine rollout game, that they were so busy very high up that they didn't pay much attention to what we did, and the fact that we ignored the brief to war game the vaccine, instead used a range of other techniques to get much closer to what they wanted. So we were lucky that they just gave us the brief and then were preoccupied with the giant health crisis.
Yeah,
let us organize it, because it worked out for the best. Had they been micromanaging us, I think we would have delivered something less valuable.
Yeah, well, that worked out well then.
it did. And it's worth sort of drawing that sort of distinction between what you do in crisis mode and what you do under normal business. There was a after that exercise on the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, a year later, I was asked to help design and run a similar kind of exercise on a much smaller scale. But by this time, the tempo was different. The environment was different. And I had senior managers from the two stakeholder organizations constantly critiquing everything I was trying to do and trying to get their sort of preferred slant on it. Sort of, they knew what they wanted, and what I was saying they needed wasn't the same thing. And there was some rather pointed comments in their after action report. The template was the right thing at the right time. A modified version of the same thing in a different scenario with different clients, but back to the normal rules of senior management must know what everybody's doing and must be able to shape it to make sure it's what they wanted to see. And the whole thing sort of becomes a bit of a disappointment. So the right technique for the right problem, but also at the right time, in the right environment.
Gentlemen, this has been a great conversation. I definitely appreciate you taking the time out of your schedules, especially because we record this later in the evenings. But to be able to take the time and join us on the podcast here. And so thank you all very much for being able to be here. It's been great having you, and especially quite frankly, this is going to sound a little weird, bringing a non-US presence to the conversation, because frankly, a lot of our guests that we have and a lot of our regular crew are from the States. And so to be able to bring that more international perspective, I think is a helpful thing, especially for the more serious practitioner focused game topics. That's great to have. So thank you all for being here.
Our pleasure.
Welcome.
Audience, if you're more interested in this, we do have an entire category of practitioner-focused articles on the site. You can just go hit it and just down at the bottom of the homepage, where you can filter by the different article types. The ones that are tagged for practitioners are the ones that fall into this category. And we also have a whole section in our forums where we've got topics related to this, as well as an inventory of the podcasts that are on these more serious practitioner-focused game topics. So you can find those a little easier. We've sort of pre-filtered them for you to make finding them a little easier. We're getting close to wrapping up season 14 here before we take our summer break. We still have connections online out there, and we've still got a couple of non-practitioner events coming up between Circle DC and Buckeye Game Fest and Origins this summer. And one last thing we do want to throw in there. If you get a chance, go hit your favorite podcast platform. Throw a rating at us. If you think we're worth 5 stars, great. If you only think we're worth 3, great. But we need whatever rating, because we got to get a certain number of ratings before we start showing up in the recommendation engines. And so we would like to start showing up in more of those recommendation engines. So whether you use iTunes or Spotify or Podbean or Pocket Cast or whatever, please take a moment and go throw us a rating, just to help those engines get moving. We appreciate the time that you've taken listening to this episode, and we'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.